Valois?
Correct, sir. You got it right.
Okay. If you just wait a minute till we close the back door and get settled in. And you'll have 15 minutes. Do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
2 minutes.
Okay. You may proceed when you're ready.
Well, thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Paul Valois, representing Gregory Anthony Taylor on appeal. I was appointed to this appeal. I did not handle the trial. Essentially, reading the Commonwealth's brief, it comes down to two things. Did I preserve the argument properly for consideration on appeal? And getting past that hurdle, if I did, was there sufficient evidence to show that Mr. Taylor used or displayed a firearm in the attempted murder of Mr. Ranson when it was never raised? He was never charged with attempted murder. He wasn't convicted of attempted murder. He was convicted of the actual murder of Mr. Ranson. So, looking at those in order, I believe that it's clear that the argument is sufficiently preserved. It's kind of hard when you're citing to an absence of a record. It makes for a very small brief. I found that out. There's not much you can do when you're saying that the record is devoid of evidence, except for say that the record is devoid of evidence. I did, in my argument, state all the elements of the offense, and I did state that, you know, he had to either use or attempt to use a pistol, shotgun, or rifle, and then I did say that there was absolutely no evidence that he had done any of those things.
Well, counsel, the problem for the court is that there are a long line of cases applying 5A20 saying that it is up to counsel. The court can't advocate for one side or another. We're the ones who make the ultimate decision. And if we don't have, if you don't cite us to any case law, any relevant case law, and you don't make an analysis as to why you think the trial court erred, you can't simply say the evidence is insufficient and cite the code section. Your argument, your analysis is a one-page analysis that cites to nothing but the statute. As Mr. Obenshain made reference in his brief, there are lots of cases that can be applied under the circumstances. There are several cases that have specifically dealt with this code section. So while the discrete point you're making may be a case of first impression, may or may not be, it's not helpful to the court if you don't give us any points, any legal analysis to support your proposition.
Well, I understand that, Your Honor, but I believe that's fairly covered in the standard. The case is cited in the standard of review, which describes in general when the sufficiency of the evidence is challenged on appeal, it describes what you have to do to get past that. So, and I think that by stating that none of the elements in the particular code section, that there's no evidence to support any of the elements as delineated in the particular code section I cited, I think that gets me to where I need to be. I don't think that there's going to be a particular case that says that. I certainly couldn't find one in researching the appellant's brief that says that when you actually kill someone with a knife, that you can still be convicted of attempting to kill him with a gun when there's no evidence that you had used or displayed a firearm while doing so. So I don't know what case that I could have cited to satisfy that concern. I couldn't find one in researching it. But I don't think I need to do that when I cite the particular code section and each of the individual elements and say that there is no evidence anywhere in the 1,200 pages of record to support any of those elements. So I would submit that we're here. We're where we need to be. Now, once we get there, is there any evidence to show that Mr. Ranson attempted to use a firearm, displayed or used a firearm in the attempted murder of Mr. Ranson when Mr. Taylor was convicted of first-degree murder by stabbing Mr. Ranson with a knife? And reviewing the record carefully, again, I find none. I don't see any evidence that that's the case. The Commonwealth argues on page 17 of its brief that the Commonwealth argued at trial that he displayed the firearm in the course of attempting to kill Mr. Ranson. again, reviewing the record, I don't find that. But what I do find is that on page 509 of the record...
Well, counsel, let me just interrupt you briefly. Didn't he actually fire a second shot?
Yes, he fired a second shot. Well, he fired two shots. Well,
one shot actually struck the intended person.
Right,
the second
which was when is up in the air. It was a matter of speculation as to which shot went... came first and which shot came second. But
is it a reasonable inference that the trier of fact could have made that that second shot was intended for the victim that he ultimately killed with the knife?
No, there's no evidence of that.
Well, the evidence is that there was a fray, right? And wouldn't it be a reasonable inference if you've got a gun and you're shooting the gun and there's two people you're involved in the fray with, that one of those bullets was intended for the guy you didn't hit?
No.
Well, what impact does it have simply because one means that's first initiated is not successful and ultimately he ends up killing him by another? It doesn't obviate the fact that he either displayed or used the gun, right?
We don't have any evidence that one means was first used against Mr. Lance. I mean, I looked through the record carefully. There's no evidence that a gun was pointed at him. There's no evidence that he displayed a gun towards Mr. Ransom, that he threatened them with a gun. There's not a single bit of evidence in there.
What about the blood on the gun?
Well, the whole scene was bloody. There's multiple knife wounds and there's blood everywhere. The whole place was a bloody soaked mess, including on my client. So, yeah, there's DNA from everybody everywhere. But that's to be expected in a scene like that. I mean,
But doesn't that support that
the victims were still alive? I mean, if we're going to get into speculation, he left the house, left the gun, and the victim's alive in the house. Nobody knows what happened once he left the house. The victims were still alive when he left. So, I mean, if we're going to get into speculation,
speculation. This is reasonable inferences from the facts.
Well, that's a reasonable inference that if he left someone in close proximity to a firearm and that person was still in there, that they could have grabbed the firearm to protect themselves, to keep from being shot at you. That's a reasonable thing for someone to do. But, I mean, but the question is there any evidence that happened? And there's none. So, again, another problem is in this case, the Kummel specifically argued several times that in opposition to the motion to strike, that he actually shot both of them. It's on page 509 of the record. The prosecutor argued that we find he got up and shot them. He has shot them, and they're trying to wrestle that gun away from him, which is exactly what the defendant said. And he said, "I got the gun first and shot them." So there is no argument from the Commonwealth's attorney that the firearm was displayed in the commission of any attempt to commit murder. There's instead, at least twice in the record that I found, there's a direct argument that, and it's a false, and it's based on evidence, it's contrary to the evidence, that Mr. Taylor actually shot Mr. Ransom when it just isn't true. And so, this is the least of Mr. Taylor's problems. Mr. Taylor has got bigger problems than this 3-year felony. But,
I think we recognize
right,
that.
Right, me too. And as appointed counsel, I recognize that too. But the law is the law. And it's just the evidence just isn't there. And it's just not right to convict anyone of anything when there is no evidence. There's certainly no evidence of fact. There's not enough evidence to build any inference. Nobody was there except Mr. Taylor. And the judge specifically ruled Mr. Taylor wasn't credible, that he didn't believe a word he said. So what do you have left? You don't have any circumstantial evidence to show that any gun was used or threatened or pointed at Mr. Ransom at any time. You don't have any physical evidence to prove it.
Except for the second bullet. Understanding that you may not agree in the course in which the second shot was fired, but do have some physical evidence that there was a second shot.
There was a second shot that was fired in the direction of the ceiling. And unless Mr. Ransom was on the ceiling, which I don't think there's any evidence that he was or that you could reasonably infer that the fact that a second shot was directed towards the ceiling, without any evidence that Mr. Ransom was in the path of travel of that bullet, in the proximity of the trajectory of that bullet at any time, I don't think there's any evidence to infer that that bullet was directed towards Mr. Ranson when it could just as easily have been directed towards Mr. Beasley, who was killed by him. So, I mean, you have two different victims, one who was shot in the, one who was shot and stabbed and also stabbed, but you have Mr. Ranson who was just stabbed. So.
Now, you don't disagree that the language of the statute of 18.253.1 allows for use or attempted use of a firearm?
No. In fact, I cited it in my in my brief.
I just want to make sure.
Right. And again, to speak to that, you know, having thoroughly combed the record to the extent that I can, hampered by the fact that I didn't try that case, but to the extent that the record is entirely devoid of any evidence that that happened. There was certainly no argument that I found at trial that this is an attempt case. In fact, the argument was to the contrary. The argument was specifically that he shot him when he didn't shoot. So that's what happened at trial.
Let me ask you this. So I'm fighting with somebody, and I have a gun, and there's a lot going on, and defendant gets the gun away from me, and I take a knife, and I stab him. Your position is that I didn't try to kill him with the gun.
No, you didn't try.
I didn't try to kill him with the gun, even though I had the gun. I was ready to use the gun, but he struggled and got it away from me.
No, merely having a gun isn't trying to kill someone. Isn't trying to. I mean, you may have been threatening, brandishing. That's a misdemeanor, but that, there is no use of a firearm in the commission of a misdemeanor.
So your position is you have to actually fire it at somebody.
Yeah, it has to be. We don't have to. Yeah, you have to use. Yeah, for an
what
attempt.
What do we do with the display part, though, of that statute?
Sure, you can display it while you're attempting to kill him.
But okay. I think that goes to Judge Jeffers' scenario. What does that do to your read of the statute?
Well, it would depend upon the order that things happen. If you're displaying, for example, hypothetically, if I'm displaying a firearm at somebody and saying, "Don't move or I'll shoot you," right? And then you knock the gun away from me and then I stab you. No, because I didn't
know
have to.
What? No,
no,
that doesn't.
That's not use of a firearm in that case because I didn't intend to kill you. I wasn't attempting to kill you when I was holding you there. I was telling you, don't move or I'll shoot you.
Oh, how do you know? So don't move or I'll shoot you is I'm not attempting to kill you?
Right, that's not attempted murder.
I'm not displaying
it might be abduction.
A firearm at you.
It might be abduction, it might be something else, but that's not attempted murder. Attempted murder, like any inchoate offense, has to have some overt act and furtherance of the crime. It has to be but for some factual mistake, it didn't happen. The bullet misfire. Now, if I pull a trigger and there's a misfire, certainly, that's an attempted murder. That's no question about it. That becomes an attempted murder because of the factual impossibility that the gun...
And you're not willing to concede that the reasonable inference of that second shot is that he was shooting at the victim.
I'm not allowed to use that word concede in this one.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Understood.
But in general, but no, in this particular, I would if I thought that it was appropriate. I'm not really serious, but in this case, it's not appropriate. No, he didn't. There's no evidence that he had took that gun and displayed it while engaging in some act to kill him with that firearm.
Okay.
You have
to. I think
we
understand.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Obenchain, good morning. You have 15 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Chris Obenchain representing the Commonwealth in this matter. As to the waiver issue, the fact that the argument is raised here that because of the cases cited in the standard of review, that somehow is sufficient to comply with the requirements of 5A20,
what about the statute? I mean, I think one of the things that he's indicating that gets him out of the 5820 trap essentially is the fact that he's arguing the elements of the statute and he's included the statute in the body of the argument.
Well, I don't think that gets him there, Your Honor, and I think what we have here is essentially the definition of a conclusory argument, that what he's arguing is that the trial court erred in, you know, applying and interpreting the statute. But he provides no argument to support that contention. He really only provides it as a conclusion, but doesn't provide any argument, doesn't provide any case law. And I think, you know, that the Commonwealth provided some case law in its brief There are a number of cases that you can look at as to sufficiency to prove an attempt. I think a very relevant case in this scenario is the Sizemore case that we cited in our brief, in which individual pointed a gun at a police officer, didn't pull the trigger, but that was sufficient to prove an attempt to...
I assume then your position is in reference to 5820. You don't have to cite cases that support your position. You just need to cite some authority, period, and be able to distinguish it or however... That's essentially what the rule says. Is that fair to say? Doesn't say you have to have cases that actually support your view. It just says you have to have some sort of authority.
Some authority, Your Honor.
Authority not be then the statute? Because it doesn't specify, it just says authority.
Well, I don't think in this case the statute is authority in support of his position.
Right, but for the 5820, let's assume, Mr. Valois' point is he has nothing to cite the court because this is a situation where his argument is that there's no evidence to support the elements, and the statute describes the elements.
The statute does describe the elements, Your Honor, but again, I think you have to argue how the trial court erred in misapplying the statute to the facts of this case, and there's none of that in the argument portion of the brief. There's no analysis as to how, in this particular case, these particular facts failed to meet what is set forth in the statute and how the trial court erred in applying that and finding that the evidence was sufficient. So I think what's missing is the analysis and the authority. I mean, simply stating the statute that he was convicted of isn't sufficient to overcome that waiver. And that would be the Commonwealth's position as to the 5820 argument.
Not to belabor this point, but are you aware of any case, either in the Supreme Court or our court, where 5820 was applied to a sufficiency case?
I cannot provide the court with that at this moment. I would be happy to provide to respond to the court as to that question once I have an opportunity to look more at it. But I'm not able to do that right now. As to the sufficiency of the evidence, if we were to reach it, I think the court's point is well taken as far as the reasonable inferences that flow from the evidence presented in this case. There were only three people in the room at the time of these events. Two of them ended up dead, and the other one is the defendant, Mr. Taylor. So there's no eyewitness to testify to what happened other than Mr. Taylor. And as was pointed out, the trial court found his testimony, not only was it inconsistent with prior statements that he made, but the trial court itself found his testimony to be incredible.
Counsel, one of the points that he makes in reference to the evidence is that we can't tell when the second shot was fired and that could impact the sufficiency as it relates to use of the firearm for the second homicide. Do you want to speak to that?
I don't think that it matters when the second shot was fired, Your Honor. I think whether or not he attempted to fire a shot, the first shot, and then shot Mr. Beasley with the second shot.
Murder is a specific intent crime, as is attempted murder. So you're indicating that the sequence doesn't matter or the evidence related to something specific as to the second victim doesn't matter?
I think it's a reasonable inference from the fact that there were only two other individuals in the room. Mr. Taylor grabbed the gun, fired two shots. That's uncontested. It's confirmed by the scientific analysis of the evidence. There were two shots fired. There were two other people in the room. One bullet struck Mr. Beasley. The other bullet apparently went through the ceiling. But I don't think the sequence of when those shots were fired matters as it goes to intent, because I think the totality of the evidence, when you look at the totality of the evidence, which is the fact that, one bullet obviously struck one of the victims and killed him, The statements that were made by Taylor to police at the scene, talking about, you know, they thought they were Superman, I was their kryptonite, there was no getting out alive, he said. I think he said he had to kill them all. So I think that those statements, obviously, it's a reasonable inference from his statements to police at the scene that he didn't just intend to kill one person, he intended to kill both of them. He had that intent to kill both of the people in the room, and he obviously followed through on that intent as, I mean, I think the fact that he ultimately ended up stabbing Ranson to death is also there's a reasonable inference that at the time he picked up the gun and brandished the gun, he had the intent to kill both men.
Do you argue that even though the trial court found that the testimony of the defendant was not credible, that that is distinguishable from the trial court perhaps accepting the credibility of the statement to the police?
I think that is distinguishable because obviously we're talking about his testimony at trial. The trial court can consider the fact that the motivation behind the statements that he makes at trial, versus the spontaneous statements that he's making to police after this event, this fight, this melee, whatever you want to call it, has occurred. It's might be considered an excited utterance or a present sense impression of what had just occurred. So there's a different...
And the testimony comes through the officers.
And it comes through the officers. So I think it's a different... just because the trial court didn't believe his testimony at trial doesn't mean you throw out all of his statements that he said as unbelievable. And in fact, the trial court had the opportunity, the trial court could accept some of his testimony as to what happened without finding his explanation for, or the fact that he never intended to kill anybody, finding that to be incredible, or his explanation for what happened to be incredible.
But the trial court didn't parse it.
The trial court didn't make any distinction there about the testimony. But again, I mean, I think his statements to police, those came in. He made those statements. Looking at the evidence, the totality of the evidence, certainly the reasonable inference can be drawn that, again, at the time that he brandished the firearm, he didn't even need to pull the trigger. He did ultimately pull the trigger twice, but I think the Sizemore case stands for the proposition that he didn't even need to pull the trigger to, as long as he had the intent and an overt act towards the completion of that offense.
So your position is 18.253.1 does not require that the ultimate murder of the victim occur by means of a firearm.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Because of the language in the statute.
The language in the statute obviously allows for an attempted murder, that he can use a firearm in an attempt to commit murder. It doesn't have to be a completed murder. And I would also point out, it doesn't matter that he wasn't convicted of attempted murder. That circumstance doesn't change the fact of whether he met the elements of use of a firearm and commission of a felony. In this case, obviously, he did complete the murder ultimately with a different weapon, but
Was the commission of the felony.
That was the commission of the felony. That wasn't the use of a firearm and commission of a felony. So.
Under the statute, we might say that the evidence would show little two, the display of a firearm in a threatening manner. But whether it's A1 or B, it says that the use or attempted use while committing or attempting to commit the underlying felony. And I'm interested in the facts that you argue support the idea of attempting or committing or attempting to commit murder by the use of a firearm.
Again, I think the fact that there were two gunshots and that there were two victims, there were two other individuals in the room, combined with his statements to police at the scene about his intent, the fact that, you know, he had to kill them, there was no getting out alive, they were Superman, I was their kryptonite, all those statements. You know, and the fact that, you know, I think the other fact that is considered is the fact that Beasley was shot in the back, so he obviously, I think an inference from that is that he was trying to get away, and so that his intention was, regardless of, you know, what was happening, his intention was to kill these men. It supports his statements that he was going to kill them. That was the only way he was getting out of there. So,
text messages, blood on the gun.
The blood on the barrel of the gun, which was the two victims' blood, not Taylor's blood on the barrel of the gun. There's, again, I think we look at the totality of the evidence to determine whether it was sufficient, not just, you know, looking at one piece by itself, but the totality of the evidence in this case, I think, demonstrates that a reasonable inference could be drawn by the fact finder that his intention at the time he picked up the gun was to kill both men. And I think for that reason, we would ask the trial court, we would ask you, this court, to affirm the trial court's conviction for use of a firearm and commission of a felony, unless there are any other questions for us on.
I did have one other question.
Yes,
so
sir.
Talk about a little bit about the text messages, the texting of this.
I guess, what would the court like me to address,
well,
as far as the text messages?
I think, it kind of wide open for you, but
I mean,
that's okay.
I think, you know, the text messages
support that there was a fight going on. And
yeah, support this the idea that there was some type of disagreement. I mean, I think the evidence too, you know, kind of undercuts his theory of the case, you know, or his defense. I mean, not only the fact that the trial court found he wasn't credible, but I think some of the facts of the case, you know, his whole argument was they were trying to force me to make methamphetamines and you know, all this kind of stuff. The police never found any, you know, any ingredients to methamphetamines, and he ultimately admitted that, you know, they said he could make them at a later time, and that they weren't trying to force him to make it that night or something like that. So I think that all of those things support, you know, the idea that the reasonable inference that, again, that at the time he picked up the gun, his intention at that time was to kill both of these men.
Mr. Galois, you've got a little under 2 minutes.
Okay, with regard to the statements he made to the police, in fair consideration of that, it's 17 degrees, he's outside in a bloody T-shirt, wounded. He thinks they're still alive. He's hiding out. He approaches the police when they get there and starts talking to the police because he thinks these men are still alive. It's not fair to infer any sort of intent to kill from that communication. He's afraid of these guys. Secondly, the...
wait a minute. What about the on kryptonite to their Superman? Isn't that something...
He's on adrenaline. He's just been wounded. He's been in the middle of a melee with guns and knives. He's a little short guy. These guys are substantially bigger than him, and they ganged up on him. He's going to say something. He's excited. That's not, that statement by itself doesn't mean that he intended to kill him. He kept asking him, are they alive? Are they alive? They were still alive when the police got there. Both men were still alive when he got there. So they got the worst of it, but that's true. The second shot went into the ceiling. There's no evidence of the order. There's nothing to establish where it was directed, to whom it was directed, nothing. Yes, maybe you can be convicted of use of a firearm while attempting to murder somebody, but you have to be attempting to murder them with the firearm. That's a necessary predicate. I can't have a firearm in my person, I guess, or be holding a firearm and then not display it in a threatening manner, just have it in a, for example, in a holster, and then hit somebody with a baseball bat and be convicted of, almost kill them, and then be convicted of attempting to, of use of a firearm while attempting to murder them. So that's where we are. There's just no evidence that this firearm was used or displayed in a threatening manner at any point towards Ransom. None. And for those reasons, the evidence is insufficient to find him guilty. Thank you.
All right, we'll come down and greet counsel, and then Lewis versus Commonwealth.